sleep genes, which pertains in general to the concept of any kind of gene affecting a behavior. And the perspective I bring to this is a fair amount of knowledge and experience in the history of this field in Drosophila. I didn't start when it started, but I came into it relatively soon after it began. It really began with Seymour Benzer in the mid-1960s. And in a sense, at the time, that was what one could do was not molecular biology and was not genome arrays and so on, but was the older technique from fruit flies of isolating mutants. And so I suppose one would say that our version of randomized clinical trials is a large-scale unbiased mutagenesis in which you have an assay for a particular phenotype, in this case, whatever behavior you were trying to study. You mutagenize flies. You test little strains that come out of each of the mutagenized chromosomes. And you out of that, you pick up new induced lesions in genes, which you can map to know that they are single gene lesions, that will in some fashion affect that behavior. And the way these screens were always done was in such a way as to make that as selective an effect as possible. So that if you were testing flies for their ability to learn, and they didn't learn very well, you would want to make sure that they weren't just sick as hell, or that they didn't have some defect in whatever sense you were trying to train them through, and so on and so on. And so this is sort of where things grew, and over many years, a number of genes were identified by this technique, subsequently confirmed molecularly. And if one looks back over them, and this was already possible to do about 10 years ago, if one looks back over them, what you find as a general rule is the following. First, that the genes that you have identified generally do a great many things in the organism besides what it is that you are interested in. But that the mutation that you happen to have produced got through your fine screen because it only affected that gene in a relatively subtle or mild way. Mild in the sense that either it was only affecting its activity in a particular portion of the fly, or perhaps only affecting its activity level to a small extent, something or other of that sort. And the genetic term for this is pleiotropy. And as it turns out, this is sort of a sampling of some of the classic behavioral mutants in the fly that have been found by means of this sort of approach. And one of them, the original learning mutant in cyclic AMP phosphodiesterase, turns out to be a mutant that also affects early embryonic development as well as fertility in females. Then another learning mutant called LAFIO, it turns out to be a component of the DNA replication machinery. How less specific could you get than that? But as it turns out, this particular allele of it was one that affected a specific portion of the brain only, and only enough to give it a learning defect. It also affects many other aspects of the animal. This is a gene, a mutant that fails in its ability to be able to track stripes in a certain kind of assay. It turns out to be a generalized developmental gene. When you knock it out, the animal's dead as a doornail. But this is a particular, very, very localized effect where one of the controlling elements for this gene that affects its expression in the optic lobes is altered, and so on and so on. And let me come down to the last example here. The circadian rhythm genes, which are probably the poster child example of the success of this approach, where you don't know ahead of time the mechanism of the circadian clock, and by going in and isolating in an unbiased way mutants that alter that clock in a way that affects multiple timekeeping aspects of it, these help to identify it. Even the period gene itself turns out now, as was shown by Rosie Andretich, who's in the audience, not only affects the animal's response to cocaine, which is hardly related to circadian rhythms, but is even now known to affect other aspects such as developmental timing in the animal and even certain aspects of training and recall. So the notion of pleiotropy as a rule rather than exception seems to hold, certainly in the fruit fly. I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out to be true in the mouse. And what is different about this kind of approach from the one that Alan just described to you? because genomic microarrays are also being done now on all these organisms, and they are an extremely powerful and revolutionary way of assaying in a very comprehensive fashion what the whole genome is doing in response to a particular kind of treatment. And as he elaborated, you can classify the sorts of things that come out of it, and as he pointed out, genes involved in these kinds of synthetic processes certainly seem to be important in them. Chaperone genes seem to be important. Also genes involved in synaptic plasticity, genes involved in energy metabolism, a fairly large number of different categories seem to be changed in at least the parallel studies that have been done in flies and in mice. And again, given the wide range of things that are affected, one comes to the same conclusion, that it's not that there's going to be some focused sleep gene per se, or at least probably not very many of them, but that what you're dealing with here is an enormously interactive network. We know the brain is an enormously interactive network. That is amply demonstrated to us. But what these kinds of studies have suggested is that genes affect wide aspects of that network and therefore wide aspects of the phenotype, and that the phenotype does not map back one-to-one with genes in any kind of process, almost in any kind of process. But in addition, what's becoming clear, particularly from kinds of a series of studies that we've been engaged in for the last several years, is that the genes themselves function as if in a network, where changes in one ripple through the system and bring about a whole variety of changes in others, not unlike what people find when they make perturbations in the brain. So there are biological network properties operating on multiple levels that are very critical here, and which are undoubtedly going to be important in sleep as well. But getting back to the more something closer to the original approach, where do things stand at the moment in terms of what we know about genes affecting sleep in the fly, based on mutant studies, not based on gene expression studies per se? Although it hasn't been the case that we have the same kind of results from many large-scale searches for mutants yet that have been done for these other behaviors. But already it's looking as though it affects, of course, a variety of different things. So one of the first mutants that was shown to have a particular effect on sleep is an enzyme, aryl alkylamine N-acetyltransferase, a brain enzyme that metabolizes biogenic amines. Flies that are mutant for this enzyme show a heightened sensitivity to sleep deprivation. They have to get much more sleep after deprivation than their siblings. Another aspect, following on this, other things affecting biogenic amines have also shown up to be relevant. From a study of serotonin receptors in the fly, I've shown this from Amita Sehgal's lab, that there is an effect of that as well. And a variety of studies that Rosie Andrejic has done here at our institute have also indicated a role for dopamine as being very critical in regulating arousal levels in the fly. One of the first genes to come out of a forward mutagenesis was done by Chiara Chiarelli, is the classic potassium channel in the fly, Shaker, a gene that is hardly specific for sleep, but nonetheless, which in the case of their mutant and several of the other mutants already known for that gene, have the effect of making the flies excessively active and short sleepers, therefore. In the realm of chaperone proteins, again, this particular one, HSP90, is one that Paul Shaw showed to be also to sensitize flies to the lethal effects of sleep deprivation. If a fly is deficient in its HSP90, it will die much sooner than controls when sleep deprived. A study that was done initially to identify with the mutant cycle that he referred to in his talk, a circadian rhythm gene, the only one of the circadian rhythm genes so far that seems to show a fairly significant effect on sleep phenotype. And then the other large class of genes that have been shown to affect this, and these are ones that certainly people who are interested in the role of plasticity in sleep have focused on, are those involved in cyclic AMP metabolism and the transcriptional regulator Krebs that responds to it. This is certainly not going to be, in any sense, the end of the story, but it tells you sort of where we are at this point. In the mouse, things have been done not so much by means of a forward mutagenesis, unbiased, but more as in the mouse world, taking a gene you know, making a mutation in it, asking what it does to the animal. There is evidence for effects, not dramatic effects, but some effects of the circadian rhythm genes, some effects of genes involved in metabolism. There will certainly be more of those with time as well. So in the end, what is this? How is this going to help the process? Help or will it help the process of trying to determine fundamentals about sleep? Well, it can't help but to facilitate that process, as it has in studies of circadian rhythms, as it has in studies of learning and memory. These mutants, of which were all isolated as part of the initial studies that helped to define the role of this system in learning and memory, and these in conjunction with the kinds of molecular studies that Alan talked about are obviously going to be important. One thing that one also needs to bear in mind is what is different about looking at a mutant versus looking at a difference in the level of expression of a gene. The expression of a gene, its messenger RNA level, is but one of many steps in the whole biological process by which the gene exerts its influence on a phenotype. The messenger RNA gets translated into a protein. The protein goes out into the cell and does all of what proteins do. And so one thing that mutations can do is to affect things that might not actually alter the level of expression of a gene, but might alter the nature of the activity that the protein ultimately has, and so on and so on. So one will get complementary kinds of information from the different approaches. But if I do want to make any point at all as something to take away with you from this discussion, it's the idea that behavior-specific genes are vanishingly rare if there are really any good cases of them at all. And I think that that's likely to hold up in studies of sleep as well. Thank you.
So are there any questions for Ralph? Alan, I'm right behind you.
Rob, I just wondered, raise a comment and see your response. I mean, as you've indicated, the poster child for sort of forward genetic approaches is the discovery of the clock, at least in this area, is the discovery of the clock genes. And if you look at the clock, I mean, there's about three things that make it probably quite attractive, and one of the reasons maybe this works so well in that. One is that you've got a very, very robust, easily quantifiable phenotype. Secondly, it's really not affected that much by environmental influences, unlike sleep, right? And then the third thing is you have these I understand they've got pleiotropic effects, but they clearly have very specific effects in the clock mechanism. So I just wonder if, in fact, the whole forward mutagenesis idea, which has been driven in many ways in mouse and to some extent in Drosophila by that example, whether that example is going to hold true in other areas like sleep. Because what we're pulling out in sleep, after a lot of work, is we're pulling out potassium channels and, you know, things that are very, very general. So I just wonder what your thoughts are, whether that example, we can actually extrapolate that easily into sleep.
It's a very important question, and one which I alluded to this morning as part of our discussion. I think that there's another aspect of the circadian clock that distinguishes it from these things, and that is that it is clearly a cell-autonomous mechanism. And it may well be that the forward mutagenesis works best on cell-autonomous mechanisms. And synaptic plasticity is, in a sense, a cell-autonomous mechanism, in that many of the factors of it are certainly happening inside the same cell. So that's one issue. And sleep may not be that way. Who knows? It may have elements of that in it, but it may have certainly some system properties as well that make the nature of the kinds of mutant effects you see on it be rather different from that. So I think that that's certainly a factor in it as well.